The Athletic.
Hello there. Thank you for listening this week to the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell, joined by Michael Cox, Liam Tharn and Mark Carey of The Athletic. And it's a continental theme this week in that I will get the guys' quick-fire thoughts on those Champions League quarter-final second legs. And then analysis of the first league title won this season in the top five European leagues. That's Bayer Leverkusen in the Bundesliga. We'll talk about the tactics behind their success, their manager, Xabi Alonso, and key players involved. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Ali.
All well?
Very well. How are you?
I'm very well. I feel like we're being treated at the moment, both in the Premier League, the Champions League, and beyond. Michael, it was a really busy evening on Wednesday night, which is where we'll start. Real Madrid beating Manchester City on penalties. Bad night for the Croatian penalty takers. Luka Modric missing for Real. Kovacic missing for Manchester City. And, of course, Bernardo Silva as well. What were the key aspects of that game for you?
I think Real Madrid were really poor. Unable to keep the ball after the first 20 minutes, really. I thought City got them on an off day. And part of that was City's pressing, I thought, was pretty good. But I thought City were really disappointing on the ball. I just don't think they offered enough. I thought Grealish was very predictable down the left. Down the right, they're always trying to get De Bruyne in the channel, but I just don't think he's quite on his game at the moment. And it meant Foden was used as the right winger, almost a decoy, opening up that channel. It was Foden's been their informed player. I didn't think he really influenced the game at all. Up front, Haaland, not particularly involved. I think 7 passes in 90 minutes, which I know he does come up with statistics like this a lot, but I didn't think he varied his position at all. What I'm finding increasingly frustrating from City, and to a certain extent from Arsenal as well, who we're going to talk about, is Guardiola uses so many centre-backs that sometimes the centre-backs often find themselves in key attacking positions and just aren't good enough on the ball. I feel a little bit harsh having a go at Guardiola because he's scored 2 great goals in his 2 previous games, but he just gave the ball away sloppily on the edge of the opposition box in a situation where in years gone by, City would have had, I don't know, Zinchenko or João Cancelo or really technical players who I know aren't as good defensively. And to a certain extent, the same is true of Akanji, who I thought actually played quite well in some aspects of getting forward, but at times just controlled the ball badly and Real Madrid intercepted. So I must say I don't have that much sympathy with the English teams going out because I think to a certain extent they've forgotten what they're meant to be about, Guardiola and Arteta. They're meant to be about technical football and they seem to just be loading up on really big players. Even City's corners, just launching them on top of the goalkeeper every time. I know he's not the best goalkeeper in the world, but 10 years ago, Guardiola's side would take all their corners short. They'd play combinations. They'd try to get into good positions. And I just thought it was a bit basic from City. I think they're a better team than Real Madrid overall. But over the two legs, I don't think they deserve to win.
Yeah, they had so many corners. And they had so many crosses as well. I was on the live briefing last night and I ran the numbers and they had 30 crosses by the end of the 90 minutes. I won't include extra time there. But that, compared with the rest of their Champions League games this season, was more than any other game. And it just felt like, in some ways, you could say it was strong from Real Madrid because they stayed pretty compact. They were playing a back five at times because they were so exhausted and quite a few of their legs had gone. But City normally, as we've spoken about before and given them plaudits for the fact that they continue to circulate the ball, they'll continue to probe in central areas in tight spaces. They just ended up still trying to go around the block. And you can, as I say, give credit to Real Madrid there. But 30 crosses with some of them were quite directed, but a lot of them were just kind of put into an area. And it was just sort of the repeated pattern over and over again with not too much quality. And granted, the Jeremy Doku cross that led to Kevin De Bruyne's goal was from a cross and he was attacking Carvajal because Carvajal was exhausted. But it just felt like it was just falling into the same trap every sort of time in terms of fruitlessly going for the cross and often to no avail.
And yet, so many more chances than their opponents, some of them better chances than others. De Bruyne particularly squandering one not too dissimilar to the goal that he scored, which, you know, on another day you might expect him to score. And a fantastic shot-stopping performance, both in the main body of the game and, of course, in the penalty shootout as well that ultimately decided things. So Real Madrid march on. I saw quite a lot of excitement online about the role of Jude Bellingham. He himself, in his excellent post-match interview, referenced being positioned higher up the pitch than often he's used to. When they won the ball, he was very high up the pitch, so he found it hard to drop deeper and get on the ball. But in the build-up to Real Madrid's goal, we saw a fabulous piece of play from Bellingham. And it bleeds into a discussion about England this summer at the Euros, doesn't it, Michael? And an ongoing discussion about which role Bellingham should play for England. And depending on whether that answer is in the advanced role, in which case, who plays central midfield with Declan Rice, or in central midfield with Declan Rice, in order to get another one in, by which we mean realistically Palmer or Foden or Saka, whoever it might be. Where do you stand on the Bellingham role for England discussion, having seen what he did last night?
Well, first of all, I thought his touch in the lead up to the goal was brilliant. And I think on two other occasions, he did something similar, like a long ball, really good first touch. I actually don't think he played very well overall. Thought he gave the ball away a lot. Didn't see him in the final third, really. It wasn't his fault, but Real Madrid were on the back foot and they weren't countering very well. I think for England, he really has to play as a number 10. I mean, his role for Real Madrid has been almost like a number 9 at times this year. So to then go back into the deep role, even considering the fact England don't have many options in that position, they do in the final third, I think it'd be quite tough. So I think he'll play behind Kane. I mean, almost without question. I appreciate the issue is then who is the second midfielder.
I think one thing he spoke about in the post-match interview was how much Carlo Ancelotti gave him and gives the whole team so much freedom in attacking areas. And you could sort of see it. We spoke about it again before that I found it quite funny that with the Real Madrid goal, that it was just a hopeful boot upfield from Carvajal, which they've kind of got it in them to be a bit sort of rugged and route one at times, but then there was the beauty of the Bellingham touch and then obviously leading into Rodrigo goal, that they do things off the cuff, and that's not by chance, that's by design. Even though that sort of sounds counterintuitive, it's they are given the freedom to do that. So Bellingham certainly suits the freedom because he's that sort of player. So if you were to give him that freedom in an advanced role, in a number 10 role for England, that's his game, and that's where he has clearly shown, especially this season, that is, you know, where he's best positioned.
Bad night for the English clubs, good night for Jude Bellingham and his England teammate Harry Kane, whose Bayern side beat Arsenal at 1-0 at the Allianz. Liam, how different is the breakdown of this game compared to the one that we've just spoken about? How did it look? How did it play out?
Yeah, remarkably similar in terms of, I think, not seeing the kind of performance you typically associate with Arsenal and Arteta, or at least in terms of being at sort of their stylish best. The first 15 minutes were probably quite good. They controlled a lot of the ball. They sort of pinned Bayern back. And I remember Mark was sort of saying, I think it was last week, about Bayern needing to or being expected to not play the same way at home, being on the front foot. They went, no, we'll sit off again. We'll be nice and compact. And I think the interesting part was really Arsenal's match winners out wide, and Gabriel Martinelli and Bukayo Saka weren't having their best day, weren't as effective, possibly looked tired. Again, maybe a bit rocked by Sunday and the emotional and physical sort of fallout from that. And there was kind of a similar reaction when they did go 1-0 down. I thought Arteta made his subs very quickly, which was telling, and did the classic thing of there was one like-for-like in there, so he brought on Trossard for Martinelli and he replaced Jorginho with Gabriel Jesus, so bringing on a number 9 for a central midfielder. And I thought it was interesting because people often sort of demand that sort of sub of get on an extra striker or get on an extra forward when you're losing. But Bayern was so good and so compact. And again, I think part of the problem was they weren't really getting enough support out wide to the wingers. So Tomiyasu played at left back, not Zinchenko, not Kivior. So again, another fairly functional player at times. There was one occasion where down the left-hand side, he did actually get slipped in on the angle, and he almost looked quite hesitant to receive the pass. Like, he knew he needed to be positioned there for the team, but when the pass came through, he tried to play a pullback on his left foot and it got intercepted. And it sort of adds to Michael's point, I think, about it's not just a case of having an overload or getting an advantage somewhere, but it's who you want in what position on the pitch to do what action. So Arsenal looked fairly flat on their feet by the end of it.
We talked last week about how Bayern would approach this match, given that they'd be back in front of their home fans. Liam, what did they do well in front of that crowd to keep them engaged, but also keep Arsenal at bay and then strike when necessary?
Well, to sort of explain the first point, I guess I made of, you know, Arsenal's wingers having an off day, it wasn't just they're not turning up or playing poorly. They were pretty made to play that way. They defended really well with the absence of Alphonso Davies off the left. So Nusair Mazraoui, a right footer, which possibly helped playing against Saka as a left footer. Played there, he's done that internationally for Morocco, and they had Rafa Guerrero as well off the left hand side, so possibly helped having more sort of defensive presence there. And on the right, they would often have a midfielder coming across as well to help out Joshua Kimmich, obviously normally a central midfielder, but I thought he did really well sort of 1v1. And then they grew into the game sort of increasingly as it went on. Arsenal sort of what looks like, I guess, early dominance and control in an away game, when you don't build on it and start really pinning a team back and making chances. Bayern started to find moments to read passes. There was a really uncharacteristic mistake from Gabriel in the first half in settled possession, where he had the ball and had his foot on the ball and took it off, and the ball just started rolling away from him, and he didn't really clock it had happened, and someone nipped in and took it off of him. You just sort of had those accumulate over time. Bayern hit more on the counter attack and had some chances, took their moment in the box in the second half when it came, just like they'd done in the first half of the first leg with two goals from two shots. So it was a really good European performance, if you want to look at it that way.
So two titans of the European game, Bayern Munich and Real Madrid, will play each other in one of the Champions League semi-finals. In the other, it'll be Dortmund against Paris Saint-Germain. And these games were beautifully poised as well, heading into the second leg. Tuesday was just as busy, as dramatic, Michael, as Wednesday. In that PSG-Barcelona game, there were so many major incidents that it's hard to know exactly where to start. In terms of analysis of the game, what were the key factors that saw PSG head through to the semi-final?
The red card. Red card completely changed the game. Barcelona, I thought, started really well. Got the goal through Rafinha. They had lots of counter-attacking threat. You don't usually associate Barcelona with playing on the break, but in this tie, they really did. And, I mean, obviously, the red card to Araujo changed things. But I was surprised that Xavi took off Yamal. I thought he started so well up against Nuno Mendes. It was their biggest attacking outlet, really. And I was a bit disappointed with that, because I thought they really quickly went onto the back foot and didn't have much chance of springing forward. I don't think they reacted well to that. Obviously, it's very difficult when you're up against the players, you know. Mbappe against Kubasi, who's clearly hugely talented, but at 17, dealing with Mbappe for 90 minutes was really tough. So it's one of those things where, you know, I'm just sad there was a red card. It just wasn't really good for the spectacle at all. And I would have been really interested to see how the game would have played out, because I thought Barcelona were on top.
It's another really good second leg for PSG, which sounds almost a bit silly to say. They weren't fantastic in the first leg, and this happened similarly in the round of 16. It's again interesting to see where Luis Enrique tweaks sort of his forward line. So what he'd done really well in the second leg against Real Sociedad was play Mbappe and Barcola as split strikers and put Ousmane Dembele as sort of a number 10. And he had the same three lining up at the start of this game, but actually played Mbappe as the nine, which at times for PSG has made them look really, really good when it obviously all clicks, because he can roam out often to the left, he can combine, it can be quite hard to mark and hard to predict, but at the same time you then lose a typical sort of box presence. And I thought one of PSG's problems really early on was not having that box presence when they were trying to work it out wide. They needed sort of more runners beyond the ball. Really, they had a front line of three dribblers, and the piece that I did after the game that's up on site now was sort of just highlighting that the goals that they did then score in their effective attacking actually came down to really their wingers becoming playmakers and knowing when to pass and not necessarily to dribble. They had their most dribbles in the first half of Champions League, any Champions League game since 2018-19, which is quite a lot when you consider Messi and Neymar been at the club in that time. I'm increasingly seeing more and more parallels now between the Messi, Suarez, Neymar team. In terms of profiles, not quality, that obviously Luis Enrique last won the Champions League with, they were the most, or the team that dribbled the most and have won the Champions League. And PSG are currently the top dribblers this season in the Champions League. So there's quite a nice sort of fit there. We've already seen it quite a lot in the Europa League this season, but we're now getting to the stage where we're seeing matchups again of teams that played in the group stage. So I'm really intrigued to see how Borussia Dortmund go about setting up defending against PSG in the first game of the Champions League season, match day one, and they went with a 5-3-2. PSG were really good. They actually really played like a team. They had lots of wide combinations, runners beyond. They scored off of a couple really nice moves. Whether Borussia Dortmund sort of changed their approach, because PSG have been really flexible, particularly up front. At times, that becomes critique of Luis Enrique, of not knowing his best team or his best way of playing. And often it's when they're not playing like his old Barcelona teams. But yeah, that will be a really interesting tactical matchup.
Yeah, Dortmund getting past Atletico Madrid in that other quarterfinal. Fifth in the Bundesliga, but in the last four of the Champions League. I mean, Atletico 2-0 up early in the first leg. Goals gifted to them by Dortmund. Sort of two sides of the same coin here. It's It's difficult to understand how this Athletic team under Simeone could throw away such a strong position when they've generally been so impressive in knockout European football under his management. But maybe that speaks to a quality, a strong temperament from a Dortmund side that I sort of get the feeling that the general sense about Dortmund is easy on the eye, lots of young players, players that we'll see play for bigger teams, but sometimes not taken that seriously, perhaps. But they're in the semi-finals.
Yeah, they've done well. I mean, I don't think they're a great side, Dortmund, to be honest. I think they're the weakest of the four semi-finalists. I think Atleti, again, will be ruining their poor defensive performance in this game. And to be honest, it's not a new thing. I mean, we associate Simeone with really solid defending, but over the last couple of years, Atleti have got this issue. They do concede too many goals. And they're also just quite bad away from home. I mean, at that brilliant new stadium in Madrid, they've got a fantastic home record this season. Best home record in La Liga, 7th best away record in La Liga. So that does seem to be a bit of a problem as well.
So two German teams in the semi-finals, Bayern against Real, Dortmund against PSG. We will savour every minute of those and we'll be covering them over the next few weeks.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
But it's time to talk about another German side, Bayer Leverkusen. Now, they're going well in the Europa League, but it's their Bundesliga title that we want to focus on today. Michael, in terms of the context of the club and German football, this is a side who have had one of the catchiest nicknames of all time, Leverkusen. Can't be used anymore. But what is the context of that name and this title?
Yeah, they got to the Champions League final in 2002 and lost to Real Madrid, of course, Real Madrid, and lost the Bundesliga to Bayern Munich, of course, Bayern Munich, and lost the cup final as well that year. So they had this reputation as, you know, they could have won the treble and very narrowly didn't in all three competitions. And that was a bit harsh because they weren't historically a huge club, or the previous decade they hadn't been a huge club in Germany. They punched above their weight massively in all three competitions, particularly in Europe. And just fell short. And it's obviously been a thing ever since. But to do what Xavi Alonso has done there in his first full season as a manager, considering that history, considering the fact that Bayern had won 11 league titles in a row, which is the longest run ever in a major European league, it is an extraordinary achievement as a manager. I mean, I think it has to be compared to when Pep Guardiola came on the scene from nowhere with Barcelona, when Jose Mourinho won the European Cup with Porto, maybe Conte's initial impact at Juventus. You know, this season, it's one of the best managerial achievements we've seen. And they're still unbeaten in all competitions. So, yeah, it's been incredible. I must admit, of the big leagues, I'm not a massive Bundesliga watcher, but I have gone out of my way to watch Leverkusen this year because they're really good and they're really entertaining.
I mean, they haven't been that close to losing that often. You know, I went back through, looked at the draws. There haven't been that many of them, but the drawn games, other than an injury time penalty against Bayern in that 2-2 draw, they genuinely haven't really been threatened by defeat. The stats, Mark, are incredible. I mean, they're currently on a 10-match winning run. So that shows the consistency, the longevity. Often we cover teams in October that have started the season well and invariably across Europe, you know, they revert to the mean. They just drift back to reality. Not this Leverkusen side. There's just so much to love about them.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we did a podcast on the likes of Nice and Girona in across the top European leagues, and they have since fallen away. And we covered Leverkusen in that episode, and they're the ones who has, you know, continue to go strong. But I think your point about the, you know, the game state kind of being key to their title is actually really important. So they've only conceded first five times in the league, which I think is crucial because it allows them to play in the way that they want to more often than not. Only five times is not that much, whereby, you know, you could come up against a team where if you're behind, you've got to start to adapt. The opposition maybe sinks into a bit of a lower block and then you've got to think of different solutions. But it shows that they maybe don't always need to adapt that much. They can implement the style that Alonso's given them. And they rarely do need a big comeback, but they sometimes need a late goal from being in a drawing state. And by my maths, they've scored 24 goals after the 81st minute in all competitions. And in the Bundesliga, they've earned 7 points from goals in stoppage time. Yeah. So they'll go right to the end. It shows the winning mentality, which we've now obviously confirmed from the weekend just gone. And no one has conceded fewer than their 3 goals in the last 15 minutes of game. So in both boxes, they end really strongly. To Michael's point, they've shown that they are, you know, resilient and they've got more potential glory to come. So they're facing Kaiserslautern, a second division side in the Pokal final. So by all accounts, it looks like they're odds on to win that game. And, you know, they look favourites now that Liverpool looks set to be out of the Europa League, to win the Europa League as well. So that could be a treble of sorts. And if they're going to carry on this winning run, then it looks hard to stop them.
Could do one of the great banishing of demons if they win all three tournaments after the context of 2001, 2002. And Michael, there's so much focus on Xabi Alonso because of how popular he was as a player and how excited everyone is about this job that he's done and projecting, you know, a future of top level management for him. Of course, he has chosen to stay at Leverkusen for next season. How much of a surprise was that to you, given how many top jobs appear to be available and for him to appear to be primed to have the pick of them?
Yeah, I suppose I was a little surprised, a little impressed, really, that he stuck around at Leverkusen, wants to lead him into the Champions League. He's clearly got a great thing going on there. They've got a couple of older players, central midfielders, really, but in general, it's a young group who I hope will want to stick together for next season and see what they can do in the Champions League. But yeah, I think it's really exciting, and I think he backs himself that he's still going to have options in the future. It might not be as many options as he had this summer. But yeah, there'll be another job for him. But, you know, I'm also pleased that we're not just speculating about what happens next. Mm. Because what I'm interested in what happens next is whether they can go unbeaten and whether they can win the Europa League. As you say, they'll probably win the cup final because playing second bottom of the second division, their opponents, which is quite bizarre. But yeah, like I say, I've really enjoyed watching him this season and looking forward to them hopefully completing a near perfect season.
It does feel like perfect storm, right? Clearly a transformative manager, but so many excellent players as well. You know, that points to brilliant recruitment. And because of how incredible the stats are and how dominant they've been, Michael, there's that tempted to say they've kind of completed football because of how good they've been, both going forward and defensively. How have they done this tactically?
It does feel like a slightly different style of football. I mean, they play a 3-4-2-1, I guess you could call it. But really, it's three at the back, a box midfield, two very aggressive wing-backs, and a centre-forward. But those four in midfield, they play so tight together. It's nothing like I've really seen before. And in terms of the end product, it's very effective. It's very efficient. You look at the big five European leagues of the 96 teams, they've got the fourth highest possession and the second highest number of goals. And I think the possession point is interesting with regard to what Mark said about game state, because often if you score the first goal a lot, you then don't need to dominate possession, so you sit back. But they have controlled games through possession. But the really interesting thing is in terms of the passing, and particularly the passing styles. Because again, I went and looked at the stats of the big five leagues, so the 96 teams there. And in terms of short passes, which defined by Opta, they're first out of 96. In terms of medium length passes, they're 10th. And in terms of long passes, they're 94th. So there's a real massive focus, like nothing I've probably ever seen before, on keeping the passing really short, keeping the passing distances between players short. And of course, that works really well because when they lose the ball, they counter-press very quickly. I mean, looking at them, I don't think of them as like a Klopp team where counter-pressing is like the main focus, but they do that very well. And their defensive record is excellent as well.
Liam, when we spoke about Inter Milan a few weeks back, it was a fantastic episode. And just listening to their tactical variety made me really admire what Simone Inzaghi has done there. What is it that stands out most for you about Leverkusen under Xabi Alonso?
Well, it's the ability to, I think, be such a good possession team and then not give up so much going the other way, particularly in a division which notoriously gets slapped with being so transitional all the time. They've conceded one counter-attack goal all season, as per Opta, that's on who scored. There's six teams that have conceded at least seven goals, and that includes Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund. So it's not just, you know, lower-end teams that are trying to play in an attacking way and can't defend the other way around. And sure, I guess their structure sort of helps a bit in the sense that you see a lot of teams now actually, I mean, they'll tend to defend and attack from this shape where they'll push the wing backs on and drop into a back five as well. But teams now do typically attack in that either sort of 3-2 build up with a back three, typically pulling a sort of a full back inside. They've got real sort of strength in that, and they're really quite suffocating to play against. Again, I know we're speaking about the league here, but a great example of that is the first leg of their Europa League game against, or their Europa League tie, I should say, sorry, against West Ham, where I know West Ham are very prepared to play counter-attacking football and defend first, but they really, really sat off. This almost had the air of like a team from a different division with the amount of, you know, respect, quote-unquote, they were sort of paying them, of sitting really, really deep. And Bayer Leverkusen just looked great and not really panicking. As Michael said, they're really sort of incisive with those short passes, lots of rotation. It's really quite patient, and there weren't many instances of sort of there are a couple of the right centre-back, I think it was Stanisic, sort of stepping out and trying to have a shot from distance, but they really sort of tried to work those cutbacks and try and score in basically every single different way possible. And they just grind teams down with this style. It's so hard to defend against for 90 minutes plus. And it showed when West Ham conceded two goals late on offset pieces. And there was a great piece on site that Seb Stafford-Law helped to write, and you made a great point in there about how, and I can't remember the four players exactly, I know Boniface and Xhaka are two of them, but they got their sort of first choice four players that they wanted, and they've really added depth as well this window, which you just need to have when you're talking about competing for a league title in the Cup and in the Europa League as well.
I think that depth is actually a really key point, and I think we've spoken before on this podcast about the established sort of starting 11 that they have, but their rotations and depth and the output from those players that have come in, I think, speaks to the really clear style that Alonso has, such that there's not a huge drop off even if you do have other players coming in, which again shows the identity is clear, etc. And some examples of that, of, you know, Patrick Schick coming in when Victor Boniface has been away with AFCON or is injured. Schick started just 9 games, had less than 900 minutes in the Bundesliga, and he's chipped in with 5 goals, the most recent one actually being a stoppage time winner against Hoffenheim. So he's come up with goals and important goals. Nathan Teller's had just 5 starts, and he's contributed with 5 goals, and that's not even his primary remit, but chipped in really well. And I was looking at the goal against Bayern Munich, their first goal against Bayern Munich, and it was Robert Andrich who crossed it in. It was scored by Josip Stanisic, and Amin Adli was the one in the box as well. And those are three players who you don't typically associate with the starting 11 for Bayer Leverkusen. So that rotation, that depth, and everyone has really chipped in and contributed to the wider success in the league, but also in the Europa League as well. Schick has come up with some really important goals in the Europa League. So testament to the whole squad and not just the team.
Yeah, I think it's genuinely 18 players who've contributed. If you order them by minutes played, I mean, Klozek has scored some crucial goals. Teller, Adli, Schick, like you say, Stanisic was crucial in the win over Bayern. Andrich has done very well in midfield. Hinkapier, another one who was excellent against Bayern from left side centre-back. And none of them are in the 11 players who've started the most minutes. It really has been a squad effort.
I genuinely can't wrap my head around the idea of a team that has scored 3 or more in 15 of their 29 league games. So in more than half their matches, they have scored 3 goals. And their top league goal scorer only has 11 goals. That really freaks my nut. Very democratic attacking team, as you've explained. I'm interested in, you know, the categorization of the Bundesliga as a heavy transition-based league, as per Liam's point, but Leverkusen really doubling, tripling down on patient possession play. Mark, just how much of a removal was that from their previous style of play? How much has Alonso had to change that style and implement it?
Yeah, well, it was well known when he came in, when Leverkusen were certainly towards the bottom of the league at the start of last season, that he had to be a bit pragmatic and allow his side to be a bit more counter-attacking and just make sure he was getting results. And then he obviously got them into the Europa League at the end of last season, where it's only from this season that you feel that he's actually kind of implemented or been able to implement his style. And one thing I like to do is look at the evolution of styles using the play style visualizations that I've made. I know we've spoken about it before, but it essentially looks at all teams across the top seven European leagues, so the top five European leagues, plus the Dutch Eredivisie and the Portuguese Primeira Liga. And it essentially, you know, ranks them on a number of different metrics. And I've tried to simplify it as much as I can to give a sort of a football idea of, you know, the evolution of each side. And, you know, you look at Bayer Leverkusen and their chance prevention and chance creation has obviously improved under Xabi Alonso, specifically this season, better in both boxes, essentially, which you'd expect from a title winning side. But that one thing that stood out to me is their press resistance has absolutely skyrocketed. And essentially this shows that they're able to progress through the first two thirds of the pitch without too much disruption from the opposition. That's essentially what that metric shows. And it speaks to Michael's point in that they're able to have these build-up patterns, really nice short passes to essentially get into the final third with a fair amount of ease because of their sort of style. So that was really interesting to me. And the other was their patient attack. And essentially this metric shows the volume of shots per 100 final third touches. So essentially how much they are likely to shoot as soon as they do reach the final third or knock it around and sort of keep that territorial dominance for a little bit. Now, last season, they were in the 19th percentile, so it essentially showed that they were counter-attacking, like I mentioned before, really direct in their approach. But this season, they're in the 95th percentile across these top seven European leagues, and it shows that they are reaching the final third, keeping in the final third, keeping that territorial dominance, and crafting opportunities with intricate play, you know, led by the likes of Florian Wirtz. So that change on the ball of how they build up and actually approach the final third and then generate shots from there is a really stark difference. I always like to look at this evolution when a manager's come in using this sort of visualization to see where there's real spikes. And this one is huge.
You know, it's one thing to build patiently and to have a lot of time spent in and around the opposition penalty box, Michael, but the phrase that often gets leveled against teams who play that sort of style but don't score a lot of goals is possession without purpose, and not being able to turn those final third entries into, well, to execute and create and score and take chances. That's clearly not an issue for Bayer Leverkusen. That's a real, it's one thing to be able to implement the build-up patterns to get there. It's almost a second skill entirely to know exactly how to execute in those last moments.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they pass the ball forward a lot. I mean, partly because of that box in midfield. They find Wirtz between the lines so often. Obviously, Boniface runs in behind. They're usually stretching the play with the wing-backs, both going in behind and in terms of width. So, yeah, they are a funny team, like the way they use the ball. Such long periods of possession, but it's not just fruitless. Mm. It's quite purposeful.
And they're also a team that has kept five more clean sheets than anyone else in the Bundesliga, 15 in total. Is there anything within their defensive or out of possession strategy that stands out?
They regain the ball quickly. I think they protect the centre of the pitch very, very well. I mean, the thing that stands out to me actually is the level of discipline. Again, I was looking at the numbers on this. All season, no penalties conceded, no red cards, second fewest fouls in the big five major European leagues, fewest shots conceded from opposition free kicks. And this is a team with Granit Xhaka in it. So it has been remarkable.
I think what we spoke about there in terms of the in-possession and out-of-possession stuff do go hand in hand, right? The more of the ball that you have, the less opportunity the opposition has to score themselves. And I think the way that Alonso has implemented that style is a useful defensive tool to have possession for long periods. And as Michael said, if you can build up in these really neat, intricate ways where you've got a lot of players close together in possession, then you also have them close together out of possession if and when you lose the ball, and you can regain the ball in high areas. So they are sort of wise enough to know as well, if they do ever sort of concede the threat of a counter-attack, they don't jump in and really go too aggressive and then naively then sort of leave space in behind. They sometimes know, okay, yeah, we've lost it here. We've lost this moment. We need to come back and sit in as well. So they're very wise, very, very well coached, as we spoke about at length. Xabi Alonso, despite it only being his first full season, has really shown just how good he is as a manager.
Excellent in all phases of the game and a brilliant collective. But let's talk about some of their key players as well. Liam, who's your favourite Leverkusen player?
Well, we spoke about how sort of good and fun the wing backs are, and Jeremy Frimpong off the right hand side is really, really great to watch. His numbers are quite ridiculous, actually. I looked at in terms of Xabi Alonso's entire time there, because he's in there for his second season now, or season and a bit. 19 goals and 20 assists in 74 appearances is sort of, you know, that's number 9, number 10 numbers. That's ridiculous. I think so. He's one off, obviously, hitting 20 in both, and I think Florian Wirtz is the only player to done that under Xabi Alonso at Bayer Leverkusen, and it's just a sheer direct running. A lot of the time the wing backs are really sort of important, I guess, release valve. Almost feels like a bit of a, not as much of a compliment as I want it to sound, but you know, they're really key because teams will press them high, they'll be building up short, the centre backs will play wide, and it's all about getting those wing backs, particularly on the right hand side, in behind. And he's been really, really great there. Crashes the box really well, gets tap ins, scores nice goals, is really creative, and probably encapsulates a lot of what the team is about. And if anyone saw the title win, they had quite a funny interview afterwards as well, where he, I think, was hiding from having loads of beer chucked on him, and gave, you know, quite a really nice, actually, detailed interview.
Yeah, Frimpong's been fantastic, and yet I don't even think he's been their best wing back, because on the other side, Alex Grimaldo plays a fantastic role. He starts as the wing back. He often ends up in a kind of inside left position because the left side centre back overlaps him. And this season, he's got 9 goals and 12 assists, which for a wing back is just ridiculous. I mean, if you're an attacking midfielder and you get those numbers, you'd be pretty happy. And of course, it's only a 34-game season. He's started 28 of those games. So it really is quite incredible. He's just got a fantastic left foot. I mean, really, really as good as I've ever seen. You know, he's 28. He's not a newcomer. He's been around. He's been in Spain. He's been in Portugal. Always looked a decent left back. But he has just reached another level. And what I find quite interesting about him is his expected goals numbers, because he's scored 9 goals. Those goals come from 4.5 XG. Mm-hmm. And I think some people get into the realms of saying, you know, looking at football purely through recruitment and saying, well, he's not going to repeat that next year. Maybe he's not such a great player. But the goals he's scored, as far as I'm concerned, if you're scoring from mad angles every other week, you've had a great season. And who's particularly good in the winning is Bayern, which, I mean, they've won a lot of games this season. But to do that in the way that they did it, I thought he played a very instrumental role. The overall shape of the team, approach of the team that day was very different. They're their lowest possession, lowest pass completion rate in any Bundesliga game this season. But they also limited Bayern to their lowest XG of the season. And the key player in attack for me was Grimaldo. Coming inside, he scored a brilliant second goal. He kind of ran in behind, put it high into the top of the net. He's been absolutely fantastic, and yet probably won't win Bundesliga player of the season.
Yeah, I feel like we're in debate club or something, because I want to put forward the case that Florian Wirtz is Leverkusen's best player. I mean, I've got some numbers to sort of show, but it is more about the eye. I think the way that he sort of has such a clear appreciation of space, his close control, he looks like a street footballer at times. I think that's, you know, the main thing to take from how talented Florian Wirtz is. But he has scored 11 goals in the Bundesliga, 10 assists, and as Michael said, Grimaldo's got 12, so slightly ahead. But that appreciation of space that, you know, as we spoke about before, the players narrow tends him and typically Hoffman, that he's able to pick up and drift across to either flank, but pick up spaces centrally. And to put numbers to that, he's had 297 progressive passes received when looking at FBref, and that's more than any other Leverkusen player. So He's got the intelligence to find pockets of space and receive those passes, turn, and then create. And
such a high difficulty role, isn't it, that? Because, you know, not to be too straightforward about it, but one of the opposition team's key objectives will be to stop him receiving the ball in the areas he wants to receive it. So everything is geared around making it as hard for him as possible. And that's why when you, in order to make yourself available is difficult enough, but then to be able to execute 1-2 touch bits of play with being pressed and so little space around you, it's something really to appreciate. To be clear, Michael, is that who you think will win Bundesliga Player of the Season?
I think so. I just think his creative energy between the lines has been fantastic. And, you know, a German player, didn't quite come through the academy because he was at Cologne, but he's only 20. He missed a year with a cruciate ligament injury. So missed the start of the Xabi Alonso reign. But as soon as he came into the side, they were different level.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because people maybe just don't appreciate how good he is and also how good he is for his age. So he scored against Bayern Munich in 2020. He was 17, and that was the youngest goal scorer in Bundesliga history. So it feels like he's been on everyone's radar for quite a while. And if you weren't that interested in the Bundesliga, you'd maybe think he was like 24, maybe 25. But he's only 20 years old, which I think makes it all the more impressive. A bit like a Jude Bellingham, where not only are they a fantastic player, they're a fantastic player for their age. It's insane. So I think there's that. And just to reiterate the point that he's getting these progressive passes so many more, but he also has the most shot-creating actions of anyone in the Leverkusen squad as well. So he's got the output as well as the intelligence to pick up those spaces. And I know that I've got a bit of a Liverpool hat on at times, but I was maybe comparing to a peak Philippe Coutinho, I'd say, in terms of that ability to just play those neat, intricate passes. He's got a goal in him as well, but plays those reverse passes and the weight of passes that others maybe can't see or execute. So yeah, I can't speak highly enough of him.
Well, it's been awesome hearing about this wonderful team. I really don't want to jinx it. It's easy to assume that they will end the season unbeaten, but funny things can happen once titles have been confirmed and motivation and whatnot changes sometimes. Michael, in terms of, you know, zooming out, what is the context of teams winning leagues and going unbeaten, you know, in the top divisions in European football?
Yeah, it would be a fantastic achievement. I mean, it happens quite often in kind of mid-ranking leagues. I mean, Celtic and Rangers have both done it in the last 5 years. PAOK Salonika did it in Greece in 2018-19. You can maybe put Porto into those kind of realms in 10-11 and 12-13. But yeah, there are some big sides who've done it. I mean, Milan in the early 90s, 91-92, had a very famous long unbeaten run. Obviously, the Arsenal Invincibles did it. Ajax, when they won the European Cup in 95... also unbeaten in the Eredivisie, which was pretty impressive. Juventus, their first season under Conte in 2011-12, I thought that was a really great achievement. To do it in Serie A, I think at that time was quite tough. There's also another couple of interesting Serie A case studies that have got asterisks next to them. Fiorentina in 1955-56 won the league while being unbeaten, then lost on the last day of the season, which is quite annoying. I'd still give it to them. I must say, I think if you wrapped up the league title unbeaten, I don't really care what you do after that. The funniest one is Perugia in 78-79, who remained unbeaten in the league and yet only finished second.
That's unbelievable. What, too many draws?
Mm. Yeah, they played 30 games, 11 wins and 19 draws. Only scored 34 goals in 30 games. Very surreal.
Well, brilliant to hear about Bayer Leverkusen. You mentioned how impressive it was for Juventus to go unbeaten in a Serie A season. That's actually not a terrible segue for what we'll be talking about on the podcast next week. We're going to look at the leagues across Europe and try, with the help of Mark Carey in particular, to work out which of the European leagues is the most competitive, the least competitive, and how you even go about working that out. That's next week on the pod feed, the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Make sure you are subscribed both to this podcast and to The Athletic as well, more widely, where you can read Liam, Michael and Mark's work as well as so many others on there. Head to theathletic.com/tactics to sign up today. And we look forward to being back with you next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.